Hello and welcome to the Morning Mom Podcast. My name is Blake Bettner, and today I'm joined by Zach Weiss. Hey, Zach.
Hey, Blake. Thanks for having me.
And I'm also joined by Zach Kazan. Zach Kazan, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you guys doing?
Awesome. What's new with you guys? Any news? any new watches? Have you bought any new watches in the last week that we need to know about?
I haven't bought any, but I've been tempted by new watches.
Tempted.
But that happens every week. So
okay. Yeah, same here. I have not, no new incomings, but the usual temptations are out there, I suppose.
Yeah. A weekly crush, right?
Yeah. I think for me, it's that new Grand Seiko that came out today. I don't even know the name of it, but the white birch.
Yeah. Yeah, I've got a few problems with Grand Seiko in that realm, but we'll get into that later. Yeah, let it begin. Before we get into that, what are we wearing today? Zach Kazan, what are you wearing?
I'm wearing a vintage watch today. It's a vintage Jaeger LeCoultre Memovox that I've owned. I bought it over the summer, this past summer, and I've just started kind of wearing it a little bit more frequently over the last few weeks. So, awesome. Yeah, that's on my wrist today.
Very cool. I'm very fond of that brand. Zach Weiss, what are you wearing?
I've on the Grand Seiko SBGA 211. I think that might be wrong. That might be wrong. Anyway, the Snowflake, better known as the Snowflake, either way.
Okay.
Yeah, we're currently working on that review, trying to get it done in little bits and pieces. A lot to write about here. Yeah. And perhaps it'll even be mentioned on this podcast later. We'll find out.
Okay.
We'll
see. Yeah. There can't be too much to write about that thing, right? You just like, it works, right?
Yeah, look, it tells the time.
Pretty good.
Something about the snow.
It's pretty good, yeah.
Yeah, no, it's it's one of those watches, once you start digging into between the movement and the dial and everything, it's like a... And I haven't actually really... I've never reviewed a Grand Seiko before, I'm realizing.
Okay.
So, like, sort of like doing it for the first time, the polishing and all the little things that they're known for, you know.
Yeah, it's hard to convey all that stuff in words, right, without seeing it.
Yeah, no, for me, it's hard to convey it in a few words.
Yeah.
I don't know, many words.
Well, look out for that one.
Yeah.
I'm wearing a Zenith A385. This was released last month. And it has the brown fume dial that is quite striking in person. I know we've all been kind of smitten with this thing in the office here, and this is on the ladder bracelet.
Yeah,
which is okay.
How do you like the ladder bracelet?
It's not bad. The style of it, I think I could maybe get used to. I don't know if it's something I would wear like all the time. It's not like the quality of this bracelet is maybe a little shy of what I would want on a watch in this price range, right?
Yeah, I mean, I feel, I will go so far as to say it is surprisingly, I don't even know what to say. I mean, it's not what I expected.
Yeah.
There's a very simple folded metal clasp that is not of great tolerances. And I mean, the thing is, when you're wearing the strap, when you're actually just wearing the watch, it's not like you care, kind of. Like, from the perspective of, like, this is comfortable, it looks good, but, like, it's not detailed as I'd expected it.
Yeah, and it's like the Seiko that I reviewed this week, the 185, the SPB 185. And I wearing that on the bracelet, I didn't consciously have any issues with the bracelet, just wearing it around and in use. It's fine. It's comfortable enough. There's nothing offensive about it looking. I think that one gets maybe a little bit more of a pass because it's $1,000, $1,200. This is many times that, and and I have the same thoughts on it. Like, there's nothing wrong with it in wear. It's not uncomfortable at all. But it's not something that you take off and like marvel at or feel inspired by any stretch or anything like that.
Certainly.
So.
I mean, and it's also just the dial. I mean, the case and the dial are exceptional. Like, the case is really beautifully machined. So like the bracelet looks in comparison really quite, just not up to the same level.
Yeah.
And I was saying like when we first saw it, I feel like there's kind of this rub of like where does vintage style and like recreation have to eventually meet like luxury and obviously they went for the look of it. And it's probably very true to the look. Maybe in the clasp is the same, but that no longer equals what you get on an $8,000 watch.
Yeah, yeah, it. Yeah, and I think, you know, maybe this one can get away with a little bit more because it does have that whole vintage vibe. So just by its nature, the bracelet can be, you know, a little vintagey feeling to kind of go under the radar there in terms of quality. But it is what it is, and I have no issues with it. Like as a whole, I guess. So, but overall, it's a very nice watch, and we'll have a lot more to say on this watch next week on the site. So I know we talked about a couple things. Well, I just mentioned it there. The Seiko SPB187. It is that that I did a hands-on with this week, which I will say, you know, right off the bat, nothing really grabbed me about it when you first handed it to me. After photographing it and spending a little time with it, it did grow on me a little bit. Though I think I still prefer the 149, 143, those ones, just because of the proportions of the dial, the bezel I prefer on those ones. But this is a really sharp watch, and it's really easy to wear. It's easy to get along with. You know, it feels... it feels a bit nicer than like the Seiko Divers that I'm used to having in my collection from way back in the day and whatever. So, yeah, Zach, I know you have a lot more to say about this.
I do. I just have strong feelings about it. I kind of, when they first announced them, I sort of, I guess I did a sort of a pre-review based on my previous experience with a similar watch, which was the SPB077, which also came from the lineage of the, I'm always going to get this wrong, like the 6139, the 1960s diver that this pulls from. Do we have that?
Yeah, it's in there. It's
6159.
6159.
Okay, yeah, so the previous 6159, you know, lineage, which also is the Marine Master 300. And it was a great watch. I liked it a lot. It was 44 millimeters, but it had a few flaws here and there. And for me personally, and I ended up letting it go. And I really never expected them to come out with a smaller, like an even smaller version of that case. So seeing this at 42, knowing that it was even thinner, knowing it had the newer 6R35 movement in it, also the kind of like a higher, to me at least, a higher end finish than the previous version did. Also a little bit better loom application, perhaps not strength, but application.
Mm-hmm.
I was really excited because this is kind of the watch I wanted. Also, totally different handset. I mean, there's a lot. You know, if you want to see all the things I kind of picked out, I guess look at that article. But so when I saw it finally in the metal, it's just like, yep, that's it.
That's
what
wanted,
I wanted. Because I love that case design. It's a very strong case design. It's like, it's, you know, like there are other divers. They're sort of love it or leave it.
Mm-hmm.
The 149s are the most normal looking. Just makes it more palatable.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have that, I couldn't see myself owning this as well, at least not right now. They just are occupying the same space as is. I feel like I'm not wearing the 149 enough anymore. But it was everything I kind of wanted it to be for the short amount of time I got to see it, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it's cool. Zach Kazan, what do you think of this thing?
I think I probably prefer the 149 and that family of divers, but this is it's a nice looking watch. I'd be curious to check it out in the slightly smaller case size, but that other family, the more normal, as Zach put it, case shape is more appealing to me in general, I think.
But those cases are, and you mentioned it, they have kind of that like old skin diver kind of vibe to them. Like they do have more of a throwback presence to them, where this feels like a little more like they could have just designed it yesterday.
But that's what's so crazy about that case, right? I mean, like the 149s come from the 62 Moss, which was the first Seiko diver, which sort of makes sense that it looked more like other divers of the era.
Mm-hmm.
And then this is like a few years later, it's like 19 late 60s that they made this crazy case. And like, you know, if you weren't initiated into this world, you would not think of it as any vintage feeling to this at all.
Yeah, definitely not. You know? It looks really sharp on the wrists, and I like the black and the blue together, but you said you would prefer the steel.
I prefer the steel. I kind of like frankly, that to me pulls it even more into modern territory, and it has a sort of mechanized look to it. And trying to rationalize, if I could own one with the 149, that would be more different. The one thing I would say about the color, you know, it's very, very nice blue. Seeing it next to the 149, it actually furthered my love of the color of the dial of the 149, which is that soft blue gray with that subtle gold.
That's like, a special dial.
It's really nuanced, you know, whereas this is kind of a more straightforward like blue-black combo.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, absolutely. Zach, would you take the black bezel or the steel bezel?
I think I'd probably go with the black.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah,
it's a new green one, too.
You know, ooh,
yeah,
oh,
the limited edition, the green dial, which is pretty sweet. Green. Looking. Green's still here.
Green's still here. It's not going away. Yeah. All right. another watch that came or that we got our hands on this week was the Nevada Gretchen Depth Master. And this is another release from Nevada Gretchen, which is kind of continuing their rebirth, I guess, of sorts. They had we saw their Chronomaster Sea Diver Aviator Diver. I've mixed those words up.
Yeah.
Which was really cool and kind of like really quirky. And I say that in a loving manner. And the Depth Master had it was very similar as well in its level of character and just quirkiness, I guess you could say. So it's a 39 millimeter case, but it's a really like squat 39 millimeters. And if you lop the lugs off, it's just a really tiny footprint that sits on your wrist. And a lot of the surface area is taken up by this like really kind of fat bezel. Steel bezel. So the actual viewing window of the watch is quite small. So it's got this like these dials that are just like packed with odd, strange details to enjoy. So it's got two different dial variations, and for that matter, two different dial designs, I should say. You can get either of them in white or yellow loom. You can get it with a date. You can get it without a date. You can get different handsets. There's four different bezel options. There's you know four different straps or five different straps. You know there's probably 1,000 different combinations, potential combinations of this watch that you could get. So the most I guess interesting one is the so-called Pac-Man dial, which is these kind of like geometric shapes that make up the hour markers, and including the 6, 9, and 12, and it's 6 and 9 that kind of look like. Like little,
I'm getting sort of abstract. Like Shel Silverstein vibes from it as well.
Yeah, okay.
You know, like I want the 9 to roll and get the triangle and complete itself.
yeah. They are very unique. So they sit up a little. I think they were like 13 millimeters thick. But the shape of the case, this looks like this kind of like perfectly fluffed pillow, and it kind of sits on your wrist like that. Too. And then these kind of like straight protruding lugs. It's interesting, and it's kind of it's very close rendition to the original, which came out in the mid '60s. This is I didn't quite know what to make of this one at first. Much like that Chronomaster or Chrono Aviator Sea Diver thing, like it takes a little while to like really. Let this one sink in. Yeah. I think it's just so unusual. Zach Kazan, I want to kick it to you because I would love to hear your thoughts on this watch.
I really like the Pac-Man dial a lot. I think that's incredibly cool. I'm less interested in the kind of more like standard dial with the traditional Arabic numerals and the aged loom.
Mm-hmm.
But I really like this type of watch with like a small... kind of, but like still chunky case. Mm-hmm. You know, the watch I'm wearing is kind of like that. This Memovox. We'll post a picture of it in the show notes. But that's for some reason that's just always been a very appealing type of style to me. That like the small footprint, but like still kind of like thick and chunky, and a watch with real. I hate the term, but like real wrist presence, mm-hmm. even though it's not like super super large and oversized.
Yeah. Yeah, what about you, Zach? What dial are you going for here?
What dial? I mean the Pac-Man is just, you know, that's just funky and really like distinctive to this watch and its history. So I feel like I would go that way as well. It's a funny watch for me because obviously this dates back to their archives, so like it makes total sense for them to make it, and it's a nice contrast to the chronograph. But I feel like having been focused on micro brands for a while, in the earlier days of Worn and Wound, like every diver that came out was a cushion case diver. And like, so I see this, and while I know there's the history, my mind goes to the Benareses, the Marineses, the
Anonymous.
Like, yeah, they, yeah, totally. And like all these other watches. So like, I feel like I've just experienced this watch a million times over.
Sure.
And some were even probably based on those old Nevada Gretchens. I mean, that's where they're drawing from, especially the smaller ones. So like, to me, this is just part of that story as well.
Yeah,
it just took a long time to kind of get back to the origin.
Yeah
Something that I'm looking at though right now that is I didn't notice at first, it's freaking me out a little bit. The numerals on the bezel are facing the wrong way. I mean, they're probably the right way for the original, but like the wrong way for how I think about bezels. Like usually,
right, so if you rotate it, if you rotate the one of the numbers to the 12 o'clock position, you will be looking at it upside down.
Yeah, but it'll be right side up at 30, which is strange.
Quite
strange. So yeah, I mean, that's
see that.
Yep Sorry.
So this is another one of those things though about the watch that you just kind of like there's certain vintage cars that you just kind of like scratching your head, why did they do that?
Yeah,
and then it just kind of adds up to the total character of the watch. And this has a lot of like little quirks about it that I think make it that. And it's 1,000 meters depth resistant too, which is probably why it feels like kind of tanky on the wrist. But
I love though that the first comments we got on like Instagram when you put it up was like, no loom pip. And it's dude, you're not swimming. You're not going anywhere with this. Let's be frank.
And to be clear, they do offer it on with a loom pip. It's just not one of the two that we got. So as I mentioned, there are four separate bezel options. There are the two that we have pictured, which is all black, and then one has the red triangle. And then there's another one that has the first 15-minute hashes are all done in are all red infill. And then there's another one that is all black with a loom-filled triangle at 12 o'clock.
So when you're 1,000 meters down there, you can have that subtle glow.
You'll be good to go.
I accept my desk diver status, so I'll go for paint.
Yeah, there you go. I don't know. Nevada Gretchen, just keep doing your thing.
Yeah.
Is all I got to say about
that.
So, okay. So another release that you had mentioned is this white birch Grand Seiko, and this has a reference number that is a little. It's like all of them, and it's it like they all sound like fax machines. SLGH005. And they're all, I have a really hard time remembering these things, right? The one you're wearing, been wearing around your wrist.
I know. I literally was writing about it 5 minutes ago, and I'm not 100% sure I got that right.
They need to get themselves sorted on these names.
Yeah. I mean, it's just,
like, call it the bird.
I mean, you should just, I think I will just not try to remember them. I'm going to go by nicknames only.
They're far from the only offender. This is a problem that's
you're right.
What is the reference of the Speedmaster you got?
I cannot tell. I'm not even going to try to. And I can't, that's another issue with them. It's like 50,000 digits long. And,
it's a great password.
It's a great or a terrible one.
Not anymore, it's not.
Okay, to this watch though, it is it's beautiful.
Yeah.
Look at so the dial is Zach Kazan, you tell us about it. You wrote it up for us.
So the I think already the watch has been nicknamed the White Birch.
That's great. I like that.
It's logical.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's based on the white birch trees that I guess are visible outside of the studio where these watches are made in Japan. And it's just a really like striking textured dial. It's not unlike the other textured dials we've seen from Grand Seiko that are inspired by the natural world. This really does though look kind of like snaking birch trees, and if you look at the dial, at least in photos, very closely, you can see this like very fine texture to it, and it's really beautiful. And this is the first, permanent part of the collection to feature the 9SA5 movement, which is their new next generation high frequency movement with a 80-hour power reserve. So that's kind of a big deal. That's something that we've kind of been waiting on for the last year since Grand Seiko announced this movement and first unveiled it. So kind of a big release from Grand Seiko this early in the year, and just a very, very beautiful watch. I'm looking forward to seeing one in person at some point, hopefully.
Yeah, absolutely. We hope to as well. The dial is quite striking, obviously, as you mentioned. It is I guess it defies kind of simple explanation. It's something you just have to check out the pictures, and we will have that linked in the show notes, if not right at the top. So one thing I love about this watch, though, is the brushed texture on top of the bezel ring. It's not just a fully polished bezel that they stuck on there like a lot of them. It's I like this a lot, and it just, to me, it adds like a whole nother dimension to the watch. And I'm kind of obsessed with like how little tiny things can go such a long way in changing the vibe of the watch overall.
I mean, I love this new case. I was really excited when they unveiled it on the first Move watch that featured this movement, even though that was in solid gold. But you know, it's a like a newish language. It's not a new language. It's just the continuation of their existing language, and I feel like it's really refined. And just pouring over cases, Grand Seiko cases, for the last few weeks, kind of reading up for this review I'm doing, like, I just feel like they've mixed everything here really well. So you have the Zeratsu polishing, you have their brushing, which is also like, maybe, I don't know if it has a nickname, but it's damn fine brushing, you know? Mm-hmm. And the bands of brushing and polish look like they interplay a little bit more here, rather than just kind of like the snowflake features some brushing, but then it's really a lot of polished, and you get a little bit less of the contrast, which is something I want in it, to be honest.
Yeah.
And it looked like from some of the pictures, like the sides of the case are brushed too. I personally think case sides should be brushed all the time, unless it's like a fully polished watch or something, or very thin. Like, it's just, I don't like seeing the reflection of my arm against it. It's just, I don't know.
Yeah.
It's not as elegant on the wrist as it is kind of on the table.
Sure.
So, I mean, it just seems like they really knocked it out of the park here with that. Yeah. And the case, I don't know, this is really something else.
What's going through the center of the hour hand there?
It looks like a little bit of blasting, like a little bit of, you know, so they broke up that mirrored surface with a little split.
Is it purely, I wonder if it's purely just for aesthetic, or if it's is there loom in it? It doesn't look like there's loom anywhere else
like
on the watch.
I don't think it's loom.
What was that, Zach?
I said I don't think it's loom. It could be, I guess, but...
I don't think so, because there's no loom on the markers, and I don't think they would do one without the other. And so there's no loom on the minute hand either.
Yeah, just a single...
It looks like some sort of very, very fine texturing, but in an interesting way, because it looks a little rougher than, like, matte blasting would be. Like, it almost like it corresponds to the birch texture a tiny bit.
Yeah.
You know?
And knowing them, I'm sure there's a reason that it's like that.
Yeah.
They do lots of just completely insane, like, micro finishing to the hands and hour markers that you can only see with a loop. So it wouldn't surprise me if you, like, got that under magnification and it just appeared totally different than what registers in a, you know, like a photograph.
Yeah. So I will say I'm most of the time I'm pretty agnostic on date windows, but with this dial, I'd really prefer to see this without a date. What do you guys think?
It's always a challenge. I mean, I feel like the textured dials are harder to sell the date on than non, because it just seems like more of a disruption to that. And that is something I get into actually on the snowflake as well.
It's kind of a jarring thing on the dial, right? Because I mean, this is gorgeous dial to kind of experience. And there's you know, the markers, there's this kind of harmony and balance everywhere. Yeah. And then that date window is like, woo.
At the same time, I feel like they're just playing like Grand Seiko wants this to be, you know, they appreciate obviously the subtlety of their nature and the texture and the poetic aspects of it, but they also want it to be like a functional everyday watch, you know?
That's true. That's a good point.
Yeah. So, and like, that's fine. I guess it just wins out in their logic, but yeah.
Well, yeah, regardless, it's very nice. A little expensive.
Well, this is like their new tier, right?
I mean, it's not worth it. I mean, it's...
I mean, when you think about that movement and everything else going on. But, like, yeah, that's their... They now have this, like, fourth higher tier sort of based around that caliber, which is interesting.
So, lastly, let's... I guess we can just chat about the Longines Silver Arrow. Which is something new from Longines that is also very, very simple, but quite beautiful in the process. It also has very interesting hour markers. Zach, maybe tell us a little bit about this one.
Yeah, so this is a watch, you know, pretty straightforward. You know, Longines is, we know that they bring back designs from their catalog pretty frequently. They're, in my opinion, of the big brands, like the absolute best at doing that. And the Silver Arrow is based on a watch that was originally released in, I believe, 1956. The Silver Arrow was inspired by kind of like the dawn of the space age and, you know, auto designs from the 1950s. And it has a supersonic plane on the back, you know, flying through a starry sky. It's sort of that type of vibe. Mm-hmm. I think for a contemporary, you know, Longines customer, it's just a very handsome kind of like everyday watch, with a, you know, but obviously a lot of vintage cues. It's sized really well at 38.5 millimeters. Just a really, really handsome kind of like mid-century styled watch.
Yeah, and the hour markers had this kind of like origami paper style effect to them that had a lot of kind of dimensionality to the dial, I guess. And there is no date here on this dial.
You got your date free watch.
Yeah, but the Silver Arrow is scripted on the dial at 6 o'clock.
Yeah, very cool typeface used there.
Yeah, it's almost an aggressive level of script. Like it's almost hard to read. I'm sure in the flesh
like
it's fine,
it.
But
like it.
But yeah, it certainly adds. You know, I feel like for some reason this watch reminds me of the movie The Rocketeer, and you know, bombing around in like the planes and the like leather jackets and you know big hair and that kind of thing. What about you, Zach Weiss?
Yeah, I think this is absolutely gorgeous. I kind of love it. I can't wait to see it in person. I like. There's nothing I don't like about it, but there's some details that I really like about it. Particularly, there's like this interesting little like silver gutter around the very edge of the dial, which kind of creates a nice circle around the dial. Which I mean, if that's actually a metallic, it would be very, like just a very nice detail.
Mm-hmm.
I like, you know, you think about like this watch, and it's the same era as, you know, Universal Gev Pole Router.
Mm-hmm.
And like both of them are made based on like aeronautics in some degree. But it's like, I love the idea that these things, which now are often translated to such like rugged watches, really like had this like sense of decorum back in the 50s. And they were still celebrating these technologies and this new stuff, but just in such a classier way than we do now.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean. Yeah, I don't know. It's a really elegant watch. It seems like there's some other. I mean, we were talking about some other time, but it's like Longines seems like they're gonna have a good year.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. So look forward to seeing that on the site. We'll have that in the show notes. That brings us to kind of our main theme today, which is based on a question that we got a couple of weeks ago, and it's something that we've kind of been coming back to in discussion. Time and again. So we thought we would just kind of make a whole episode about it. And this is, what one small change would you make to a watch to make it perfect or better or more suitable to us? I don't know. But I think that the driving point of the question was, you know, what watch do you really love? But it's just like one tweak away from like being in an area that you would want it. Yeah. That you would buy it or really lust after it. Or I don't know. Like, you know, there's a lot of watches out there that you know, you get excited to see, and then you read like one detail about it, and you're kind of, it's got this or it's got that or whatever it is. So we thought we would take a stab at this, and I'm feeling that all of these things are gonna fall within kind of a few categories. You know, it's not gonna be like, well, I love this watch, and if it was just cheaper, then it'd be perfect.
I could say that for so many watches. That's the detail I'm staying away from because it's too easy. But
make the Rolex Daytona $2,000.
$2,000.
Yeah, perfect.
Everything about it is perfect. And speaking of the Daytona, I've got a big gripe with that watch. It's power center link, which is
there. Let's hit the ground running.
Yeah,
polished
that's,
center
that's,
link.
That's me. And okay. and I've owned two ceramic Daytonas, and both times I've gotten rid of them because of that.
Wow.
And I like Rolex bracelets a lot. I think they're really comfortable and they're really well built.
Is it the blinginess of it?
Yeah,
or
it just
is it
takes
the scratchiness?
No, I don't mind the scratchiness at all. It's just the blinginess. And, you know, I it's just not, you know, every time I look at my wrist, I feel it. You can feel it. Like, oh, that's not quite me. And I'm sure there's a lot of watches that you try on and you look down and it's just not,
yeah,
it's just not jamming with like the shirt you got on, the pants, you know, whatever it is to make you feel like this is a good part of my getup. And it feels, yeah, like,
well, just
feels
don't
like
wear a shirt and pants next
time. Just don't wear a shirt and pants. You're going to wear a Daytona, lose the shirt and pants. Yeah. Okay.
Please wear a shirt and pants. I think that's,
when Zach is in, yeah, around, at least. So,
Blake, would you consider, or did you consider when you owned the Daytona brushing the centerlings? I know that's something that a lot of, maybe not a lot, but at least a handful of Rolex owners do with their GMTs and other watches with polished centerlings.
Yeah, actually, that's kind of why I wanted a modern sub for a long time, because I thought, oh, I'll just use the bracelet on this. And right now, I've been kind of looking at the Biala RO, the steel Pepsi GMT, for a long time, but I wouldn't wear it on that Jubilee. I would put just a fully brushed Oyster on it. But I don't think I'll go that route. And I prefer to kind of wear watches as they were from the factory on the bracelets, at least. But the Submariner that I do have, one criticism is often the lugs, the fat lugs on it. Mm-hmm. And I think that would be a lot of, you know, that would be like a single change that you'd make. And I've owned one for a while now, and I quite like it a lot. I think the complaints about the lugs are exaggerated, and I think it wears quite small and thin on my wrist. I don't think they're heavily offenders, but I would, you know, if they were a little thinner, I certainly wouldn't hate it, and then I would take it. I'd probably like it a little more. I have thought about having the lugs, like a chamfer put on them. Mm-hmm. By a third party, because it's mine. I don't think I'll get rid of it. You know, it's all scratched up and it's dinged up and all this. So like, why not? I guess, right? What do you guys think? Should I not?
I mean, there's no going back.
Yeah, there's no going back.
That's the issue there. But I personally have always felt like the modern subs are out of proportion. Anywhere on my wrist or not on my wrist, but mm-hmm. I haven't worn it for a long time.
Yeah. What about you, Kazan?
I think if you, I mean, I'm all for like doing whatever you want with your own watch. I certainly don't have any like kind of puritanical views on that at all. I think if you do get chamfers put in onto the lugs, you should like just for fun, like get an engraving on the back that says like, I did this on purpose, Blake Bettner, or something. Just like, you know, just to memorialize the whole endeavor.
But, I do like that idea, actually. You have an engraving on the back. All right. So there's a couple just low hanging fruit off my list. Zach Kazan, lay your gripes on the table.
So I thought about this from I literally looked at my watch box and looked at watches that I own and thought of, ways that I would change them, little subtle things I'd do. And, I own a Tudor Pelagos. I wear my Pelagos a lot, probably more than any other watch that I own at this point. That's kind of become like my daily wear. And I don't have it's wearable at its current thickness, but I think it would be like really perfect if it were just a couple millimeters thinner. And it's 500 meters water resistant. It doesn't need to be, at least mm-hmm. not for me. You know, I'm not, I wash my dishes wearing that watch, but I certainly am not doing any diving, and certainly not any saturation diving. I don't need the helium escape valve. So,
yeah.
If Tudor were to redo that as a, as a 300 meter dive watch without the helium escape valve, and can make it a little bit thinner, kind of more like, more like in the Sinew 50 profile, but not even that thin. I think it would really be perfect.
Well, Pelagos in the footprint of a U50. Signed me up for that. Yeah. I think, helium escape valves are another easy kind of low hanging fruit here. I know you generally don't like the Seamaster 300, regardless. I don't mind it as much, and I think without the helium escape valve sticking off there.
What's such a funny thing too? I mean, the helium escape valve in general, like, I'm pretty sure Jason Heaton wrote the article on why they're not necessary.
Yeah,
he is a diver after all. But there are automatic helium escape valves. So, like, if you were to choose between the automatic and the manual at this point, which would you choose regardless? So, like,
the Sea Dwellers have them, and you don't even yeah. notice them. You don't, yeah.
Or you could have a, you know, something like the Tuna case, which apparently doesn't need it because of the shrouded case design. I don't really know if it works, but, you know, they figured it out.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, I'll say that the Seamaster 300 would be a watch that would be much more in my wheelhouse without that thing. Yeah, and it's you have to unscrew it.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Like it can.
Jeez, yeah.
The Pelagos, at least it's there. The rest of the time, it's essentially a hole into your case that has like seals that could eventually go bad. Like, it's actually like more of a liability and anything else. But in the rare, ultra rare circumstance, you went saturation diving with it.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you just want it to deal with this helium problem on its own rather than having to be like, oh shit.
Which it will. So Zach, if you decide on a career change, you're good to go.
If I find myself randomly in a helium rich environment and I'm wearing my Pelagos, I know that the watch will be fine.
Yeah,
I'll sound like a chipmunk, but
who's laughing now?
The watch will be okay.
Yeah. All right, Zach Weiss, what are you thinking?
So I think I almost have to thank watches for having one thing or so or more wrong with them, because it prevents me from like, that's like, I'll focus in on that thing as the reason to like, you know what, that one's not for me.
Yeah,
it prevents me from like getting obsessed with them and ultimately wanting them too badly. But I was thinking about a watch that I recently purchased. It was actually the watch that spawned the article that I wrote. We've all been there. And it was a Squale 30 Atmos 60th Anniversary Edition. So this is their like throwback to the essentially like the 50 Fathoms watch that they had made in the early days of Squale. And there's some history there between them and Blancpain. And, you know, there was that really cool new old stock reissue of it. Yeah. But this is just their modern one. And it's listed as a 39-millimeter watch. It's not a 39-millimeter watch because the bezel overhang is closer to like 40.5 to 41, which is enough to make a difference. But
that's
not the detail.
Okay.
It has 22-millimeter lugs.
Ooh, yeah.
22-millimeter lugs do not belong on anything under 42. And even then, I think they're
stretching it. It's
questionable.
They have
to be right for the watch. So, and that's why I got rid of it. It was like this just overly fat leather band with this watch that had this sort of vintage look, and it just didn't mix. It didn't mesh, you know, it needs a 20 millimeter. So that one detail, put the 20 millimeter on that, I probably still have it today. It literally was the one, like I could not get over it.
Yeah.
You know?
Huh.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. I guess, not something you really think about until it's on the wrist. Right?
Yeah.
That's a thing that does make a big, especially with the watch at that size.
There's strap proportions. And I feel like that's why, I mean, these days you're seeing more and more 19s and 21s because brands are trying to be more sensitive to it, even if that ends up in like a more annoying third party, you know, situation.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, I mean, when proportions matter, obviously, you know.
Yeah.
But like, go for the big wide strap if you're going, you know, something like, Panerai's obviously have really wide lugs, but they're these fat watches, and Bell & Ross square watches have like, I don't know, they're probably 24 millimeters, but the straps often go past the lugs to like continue those straight lines around the wrist and give you that kind of cuff look, which like that all makes sense. But like, imagine a Panerai, a 46 millimeter Panerai with an 18 millimeter strap. It'd be equally as wrong, you know?
Yeah. So. Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, I'll get into one, and this you might sense a theme emerging with me. So Breitling has quite a few pretty handsome designs, in my opinion, and watches that I like quite a bit. I think the 53 re-editions, the Swiss Air Pan Am TWA chronographs, the Top Time that they came out with. I think these are all really great looking watches. But they all have Those aviation ones are all a little bit too big for me at like 43. If they were like 41 or 40 or 41, I would give it to them. You know, I'd be all about it. But they all have like fully polished cases and the lugs in particular on the Top Time, on these, like the Pan Am, chronographs, the fully polished lug up top. I don't know why that's something that I have a hard time getting over, because I would really like these watches if they came in like more of a just sporting brushed, case that you could like throw on with the it just feels like you could dress them down a lot more. To me. And they're, speaking of Breitling watches, right, I think there are quite a few just little hitches here and there with a lot of their watches that would make them a little more palatable to me, or to my taste actually. But the polished lugs just in general on these models just kind of push me over the top. Sorry to fly off the handle like that.
No, yeah. It's okay. It's okay. That is an extremely flashy watch.
Yes, and it just pushes it over. You know.
Yeah.
I
think Breitling knows that their customers want to be noticed
from miles away. But I'm saying, like, hey, Breitling, you know.
Yeah, it's surprising that there isn't at least a model, you know, like, where is that? Where, like, yeah, it's funny. I just, like, also, like, I mean, do you guys keep, like, you know, I because of glasses and a lot of watches, I always have, like, a polishing cloth around. But, like, I don't think that a lot of people in the world carry polishing cloths with them. And anything that's polished like that is going to get extremely dirty from fingerprints. And that drives me nuts. I don't know about you guys.
Yeah. And this, and like on the top time, it's even more like it's a bigger lug. And it's in this one in particular, I feel like it would benefit so much from some brush surfaces on this case. I don't know. Am I overreacting, Zach Kazan?
No, I don't think you're overreacting. I think that, you know, Breitling for a period of time just really leaned into that like fully polished look, and that sort of like defined their aesthetic for a long time. And you know, I don't think it's aged particularly well. On the other hand, I don't know if you've noticed, but sometimes I'll just type Breitling into watch recon, and like these watches are so cheap, mm-hmm. like on the secondhand market, I think because of that, people just do not want these high polished you know, sports watches and aviation watches mm-hmm. anymore. So a lot of Breitling watches from this period are like really good values if you, you know, if you like that style, or you don't mind it. The other thing that kind of springs to mind is that, you know, these are ostensibly, you know, aviators' watches. Isn't there kind of like a principle in aviation that you don't want highly reflective surfaces, you know, in like a cockpit situation? I feel like that's something that other watch brands have kind of introduced in their pilots' watches, that, you know, because you don't want, like, you know, the sun reflecting and off of a watch case and, you know, interfering with your vision. So it's just kind of odd to me that Breitling ever went down that route.
Yeah, I'd accept that. I mean, come on, this is a great looking watch.
Yeah, that's very cool. Time. The Zorro, right?
Like, yeah, it's 41 millimeter. I mean, this is like right in. I like, this is a watch that would very much interest me. There's no date on it. Like, it's very much like the original one. But yeah, and it's the same with Hoyer Carreras, right? Because they have the fully polished cases as well, and I think those are extremely handsome watches. You know, it's just
like the more vintage styled ones.
They're, I mean, like both of them, right? They all have, like, the old ones and the new ones are. It's a full polished case. I might be wrong on that on some of them, but I feel like by and large, the ones I see have. And I know that because it's something that I look for, because a lot of these I really like. But alas, they are polished. All right, so let's move on to what do you have next on your list, Zach Kazan?
So next on my list is another watch that I own that I have a little quibble with. And I touched on this in my review of it recently, my Grand Seiko SPGH 271. Specifically... The bracelet, I feel like, and the clasp actually, I think needs a micro adjustment feature. And more generally, I think that any modern bracelet put out by a big watch brand ought to have a micro adjustment feature on the clasp. So that should be the challenge that they set out for themselves. You know, I know that there's a benefit to not having it, because you can make the clasp you know, quite a bit thinner, but so, you know, some brands do it really well and implement, you know, really solid micro adjustment features under the clasp without, you know, creating something that's really unwieldy. And I'd like to see Grand Seiko and other brands do that, because that watch would, for me, be quite a bit more wearable on the bracelet if I could just adjust it a little bit.
Particularly if it's something that you can just adjust on the fly, too.
Yeah.
Right? Like that makes, like, the... the Oyster bracelet, the Rolex. There's a few others. That I feel like yeah.
Whenever I, that's like not something that I think I was really even aware of how well that worked, because it's not, I haven't owned a modern Rolex or a vintage Rolex for that. But when I've played with them, I've been really impressed by what a like a slick little system that is.
Yeah, know? Yeah, it's great. And they're, yeah, their bracelets I think are top notch. And another example would be the Speedmaster that just came out. What a drastic improvement the bracelet was from the prior generation. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's a $6,000. I feel like up in that price range, it really kind of shows like, hey, you got to step your game up if you want to be playing in this realm.
Yeah.
Like the expectations should be much higher than what they are. And Grand Seiko included, right? And I would say that from an
assist. And Zenith.
And Zenith, yeah. I would say that from...
So that clasp has more micro adjustment holes than I've ever seen on a clasp. Like but
50,
it's like
there's like 50 adjustment holes in the back. Like I'm like
but
it would cover
it's
probably
just
three
folded
links.
Metal, so it's not it's lacking any comp. It's lacking any like slick.
There's no sophistication here.
But it's got a lot of micro adjustment.
That's historic to the brand. I owned a vintage Zenith Zenith Defy from the 70s on a lobster bracelet, and that had, you know, just like you're saying, Zach, it must have had like a dozen, you know, micro adjust holes that you would need a tool to adjust. So that's definitely a legacy design from Zenith. But honestly, like I'd even settle, you know, on my Grand Seiko for you know, for a clasp that could be adjusted with a tool, you know, over a clasp that can't be adjusted at all. You know, something on the fly would be great, but you know, I'd settle for kind of that old fashioned style too.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
Understandable. Yeah.
Yeah, bracelets. Boy, that could be a big one for this question. There's a lot of iffy bracelets out there. But you know, thankfully we're of the ilk that likes to kind of play around with different straps a lot, and you're not even a bracelet guy.
I'm not. I'm trying to get a little more into bracelets, and I've been wearing them a little bit more as of late. I mean, I'm wearing Snowflake on that. Granted, it's a titanium bracelet, which is I haven't worn a full titanium bracelet, at least not for a prolonged amount of time, and it's incredibly wearable. Mm. Forget it's on. But the C65 Sandstorm we did, like, with Christopher Ward, I've been wearing that on the bracelet because I kind of envisioned it on the bracelet, at least the steel model.
And they do a pretty nice bracelet for the price.
Absolutely. And they have a micro-adjust mechanism, which is nice. It's a big clasp, but the micro-adjust, I think, makes it worth it. But yeah, I mean, for me, the problem is the tightness of bracelets, the lack of flexibility on bracelets, and, you know, just the kind of... the feeling of something that like massive or on my wrist, it just wears on me after a time. But like the best bracelet I've ever worn was a long time ago. I had a Tudor Date Day, like a vintage one. Mm-hmm. I think it was from like the early 80s, something like that. And it had just like a totally stretched out Jubilee. And that's like not wearing anything at all. You know, it's so comfortable.
The new Jubilees are very comfortable as well. Yeah. It's just the, you know, that look is not for everybody.
But, like, I don't mind, you know, even on the new Speedmaster bracelet, they engineered in, if you want to give them some credit, like, the flex. Like, it's no longer an ultra-rigid bracelet, which I feel like was what people wanted for a time, is, like, this thing is solid. That's not comfortable, you know? Yeah. You need flex.
Yeah, you're absolutely right there. And it drapes over the wrist with ease. I mean, when you're looking at it from the top down, like, you can see it, like, curving
to,
like, the bones.
Follows your anatomy.
It really does. And it just wears, like, silk because of it. Step up your bracelet game, people. And shout out to another small brand that does bracelets really well, is Monta.
Monta
does it really, and they have a micro adjust on the fly too system. All right, Zach Weiss, do you have anything else you want to...
I'll hit one that I'm feeling you have some comments on too. So that'd be the Speedmaster Mark II. Which I think came out in like 2014, the newer versions around there. So I'll just start, like, the reason I like those watches in the first place is just, you know, I wrote in the recent article about the date Speedmaster I have, like, I feel like to ignore the non-speedy pros is at your own peril. They have a really wonderful history. Anything that's a Speedmaster on the dial is cool. It's part of a great, like, story and just, you know, brand history of chronographs, racing chronographs. And they did funky stuff. And obviously the Mark II was kind of the first funky thing they made, in that it was a totally new case shape. But the original Mark II basically had the same dial as a classic Speedmaster, you know, very similar at least, and it had the same movement. So it was a manual wound movement. The newer version, the Mark II, They kept a lot of things very similar. I don't even mind the modernization of the dial. Like, I think they did a good job of it, of mm-hmm. making it kind of crisper and sharper and having more texture to it. And they loomed the tachometer and cool stuff like that. And the case looks beautifully finished. It's a touch larger, I believe, but not dramatically. It's like half a millimeter or something like that.
Yeah.
But it's the automatic coaxial movement. So it adds a lot of thickness to it. And then it just doesn't have, you know, the manual winding. So for to me, if it's a Mark II, it should be a manual wound. They should have used the Time 861 movement. I know they couldn't have called it a coaxial at the time, but it would have been truer to, I think, the experience of the Mark II, which is also a manual wound chronograph.
Mm-hmm.
So, long-winded, the one thing I'd change is to put in the new 3861 in that, yes. Which I wouldn't be surprised if happened.
It needs to, because it would solve my problem with this watch too, which is, when I look at this, we're looking at the racing dial Mark II right now, which
absolutely
is gorgeous.
Gorgeous. Yeah.
There's only one thing I see looking back at me, and it is the date window down at 6 o'clock. This, and again, I usually don't have such a huge problem with date windows, but this one, because the originals, I don't think the originals had a date.
No, because the manual wound movements.
Like this needs, it doesn't need to be there. It should have that manual wound. It would shave probably a couple millimeters off the thickness, and it would just do wonders for the dial.
Yeah,
in my opinion,
The date honestly is not the thing that drives me crazy the most. Like if you're gonna put a date on a chronograph like this, like. Your options are what, like 4.5 or 6 or 12? Yeah. But 12 is Heuer.
I almost wouldn't even mind it at 4:30. Because it just cuts.
But it's a bit of a lose-lose situation for them.
It just needs the 3861. Lop that date off there, call it a day. Zach Kazan, are we crazy?
No, I fully agree. Put the hand wound movement in there. I love the look of that watch, but it never really appealed to me as a possible watch to purchase because of the big thick coaxial movement that they stuck in there.
Yeah, it's a simple fix, sort of. I mean, it's a totally different watch, but it's a simple. But yeah, I mean, if for no other reason than like this, the classic gray orange racing dial, like, I mean, it should be incredibly popular.
Oh, yeah.
Know?
It's a fantastic. Imagine if they put that into that dial on the new Speedmaster. It would be like, game over.
Which, I mean, that has existed on Speedmasters.
Yeah.
Though I feel like, it's like ultra rare
Japan racing. Yeah. Boy, it's sharp, though.
Yeah.
I wouldn't hate it if they did that. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I'll also say, like, I'm sure that watch as is also a ton of fun. Like, that's, but we're talking, like, hypothetical perfection versions here.
Yeah.
And, like, that would be a watch on my personal, like, I mean, want list. Doesn't mean mm-hmm. I get it, but on my personal want list, like,
Mm-hmm. All right, so I have one that's it's just a small thing, and I like Nomos quite a bit, but I'm not a huge fan of wire lugs. So a lot of their watches that I like have wire lugs. so I would just put I would go
so in general
just
no
in
wire
general
lugs.
Wire lugs because I don't know, to me, like, part of the beauty of a watch is like how the case. Is engineered, I guess. So, like, the shape of the case as a whole is part of what
mm-hmm.
I don't know, gets me. And the lug just kind of feels like an abrupt transition to the strap that I'm not particularly fond of myself. Am I the only one here who is not a fan of wire lugs?
So are you thinking of the Metro specifically?
Yeah,
it's a Metro lug.
Yeah. Yeah, because the club is the one that I like.
The club's fat
because
lugs.
The club has
yeah.
just kind of a normal traditional case to it. But yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't personally mind wire lugs. I think there's some times where they make more sense than others. I don't like changing straps on watches with wire lugs because it can be very difficult because there's just a lot less surface area to work with there. But the time where I like it the most is when a watch has a little bit of a larger diameter. But then by getting rid of the lugs entirely, it makes it a smaller watch overall. Like, there is no lug-to-lug measure, say, to measure. So, like, it'll sit more comfortably on the wrist.
Yeah, I feel that. I mean, like this Ahoy in particular has these. I don't know if you call
that's
them
not wire a wire lugs, lug,
but that's yeah. just a.
Oh, so you just don't like thin lugs? It's that's a, the, it's a thin, that's like, a classic.
It looks like an afterthought. Like they designed the like perfect circle, you know, case in the beautiful dial, which is great. And they're like, oh, we got to put lugs on there. Let's, you know.
Well, it's
just pop these things in.
I imagine because that's like based on the Bauhaus style design that probably was like at one point a soldered lug in the late 1920s, and it's just. Stayed yeah, around you
yeah,
know it's
yeah
they're very harsh. I feel like I don't particularly like on the Ahoy I wish it was a more modern fluid lug, whereas yeah. like you know on the Tangente or something where it's all about that aesthetic it makes more sense to me. But
yeah,
that's yeah, what do you think of the Tangente the Tangenta, Blake? Are you okay with those lugs?
See, it's just too it does nothing to add to the design of the case to me. It's just, it still feels
it's a cylinder with metal lines.
It's serving the function of like putting the strap on it, right? So they had to be there, but they don't add anything aesthetically to the case that I feel like makes it a better design. And maybe that's the point. Like it just keeps all like the focal point on the dial itself, yeah. which is very lovely.
I agree with you to a point. Like to me the lugs on those watches, the Metro, the Tangenta, the Ahoy, they don't really they don't add something to the watch the way that like the club, the lugs in the club, like those actually they help the watch. Like they help the case. It looks better because of those lugs. I think there's something kind of like neutral about the lugs on the Tangenta that doesn't really appeal to me. I will say I owned a Tangenta at one point, and it to me it wears very comfortably, mm-hmm. You know, with those lugs, kind of like surprisingly so, because it is sort of like a harsh, severe look, and you wouldn't expect it to be, you know, a comfortable watch to wear. But something about the length of the lugs and the angle of them makes the watch very easy to wear. But yeah. I would say it's not a look that is like super super appealing to me either. I wonder what they would do if they ever decided to like, you know, refine that or change that up a little bit.
Yeah, and you know, I'm sure some people love it, and that's and that's great. It's just not my style. But I like the Ahoy a lot.
Yeah, I guess I just tie it to like the history of it. So it's like. It's just it is what it is in a sense.
This is the way with this thing.
Well, it's the same with like the Stova Antea, which is also, you know, direct line from the Bauhaus watches of like the 1920s. You know, Stova actually made them back then, and like I have one of those watches because we did a limited edition with it, and it's just like that watch I couldn't imagine without being different.
Yeah,
I don't know,
yeah,
but
I appreciate that. All right, Zach Kazan, what's next on your list?
So next on my list is a watch that I'll preface this by saying I don't care about this watch at all. But it's sort of like it's been in the news a little bit over the last couple of weeks. And so like I saw a photo of it and it just sort of like jumped out at me as something that looked wrong. And that's the Patek Philippe 5711 Nautilus and that date window. And like I'm like you, Blake, I'm kind of I'm very agnostic when it comes to date windows. Like I never really have a complaint. With a date window, and I saw a photo of this of the 5711, and I just thought like, it's breaking up this blue dial with a very obvious like texture and depth to it, with this bright white date window, and no one ever really talks about that. I feel like I never hear any criticism of the Nautilus with respect to the date window. Everyone always talks about the price and the availability, and there's certainly a lot of people that you know have gripes with the Nautilus, but where's the date window crowd? You know, when it comes to the 5711, I feel like they've gone silent, and that's kind of weird to me.
All the hype can do fuzzy things to your brain.
I don't think anyone's stopping to actually think about the watch anymore with that and a handful of others.
Yeah, no, I'm completely with you though on this one, Zach. They couldn't even be bothered to match it to the color of the dial. So it literally is just kind of like a staring back at you. It's the same with the Aquanaut too. 5167, I think maybe. With the black dial, you know, it's a very nice dial design if you like that, and it's not like it's a very large watch, so it's kind of this really nice experience that they've created, and let's just cut a hole in the middle of it and stick this white date window or the date wheel behind it, and Yeah, I mean, it is what it is. And, yeah, I think the Royal Oak is, it's the same way. But
yeah. There's like the Royal Oak Offshore in particular, that date window is like a bullet hole. It's gigantic.
Those are kind of crazy watches. The offshore is for more extreme people, Zach. It's okay, true. you wouldn't understand. You're just not extreme.
I just want my Mountain Dew edition.
Yeah.
If that exists, that'd be cool.
Sorry, AP. We love the okay, Zach. Yeah, no, I think that's a totally reasonable one. All right, Zach Weiss, you got any last thoughts?
Yeah, just because, I mean, I referred to it in the beginning, sort of, and I'm wearing it right now. So in my time spent with the Snowflake and ruminating on it, you know, the detail here, and it's very hard because I can also, I'm kind of just nitpicking at this point, because I like the watch a lot as is, but if I were to, like, make a perfect version of it for myself, like, and I could only pick one thing. the power reserve just doesn't feel necessary.
There it is.
And yeah. Much like, I mean, we were just talking about on the new white birch, mm-hmm. The complications, in this case power reserve and date, feel like disruptions to the elegance that is there otherwise. You know, and I feel like the power reserve on a 72-hour automatic, it just is superfluous. Pronounced better, you know what I mean? You just don't need it because... I mean, the watch is going to stay wound. It's not like some exceptionally high power reserve. So it just feels unnecessary. And I feel like, you know, in to give Grand Seiko some credit, I feel like they've recognized that the power reserve is less needed than it once was, or it's less a feature that they need to put on the dial side. So they've started to move them to the back of the dial, or the back of the watch on the movement, which is also like infinitely cooler to me that like before you put on your watch, you check it and then you know, and it's
and
just
that makes
for you.
Sense.
But here really conceptually, like I'm not saying across the board, the power reserve should be gone. I feel like there are people that do feel that way, but on this dial, it's like, there's this very contemplative sort of moment you can have with it because of its like expressing this snowy field, and it's just sort of broken up by this suddenly very unnatural form. So that's my conceptual issue with it. But in this the pursuit of perfection.
I agree with you. I think when I first heard this question, I made jotted a little note next to Grand Seiko: power reserve, date windows, -WTF. and I think there's a lot of Grand Seiko watches that that to me would be much more palatable without the power reserve there. I feel like it's like a thing of theirs.
It's so funny because I also love power reserves on a lot of watches. I think it's like a cool feature I almost want to see more of, and like
creative interpretations of.
Yeah, and I guess it's just a matter of like, why is it there and what is the purpose, you know, it has. Like something like, you know, the Oris Caliber 110s, which have that giant 10-day like subdial that, you know, and the way it kind of scales because it's a non-linear, like it's very cool. It's part of the story of that. When it's, you know, an ETA 2824 or something like that, that happens to be, or like there's the Miyota movements that have power reserves on them. Like beyond adding complexity, it serves no real purpose. Like you don't really need it there.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. I really like the idea of incorporating a power reserve onto the case back.
Yeah. I think more complications should be on the back case back. That's so cool. Yeah.
Zach, where do you stand on power reserves?
In general, I like power reserves. I agree with you guys. I think that the you know, the Snowflake and you know, certainly most, if not all, Grand Seiko spring drive watches would look better without the power reserve. But I'll defend it just in the sense that it's a immediate visual differentiator for spring drive watches, and I think that's probably why Grand Seiko is stuck with it. You know, for so long, it's sort of like, you know, literally kind of like a badge of honor, you know, for them to put that power reserve, on the dial. Although, like, there's nothing about like the length of the power reserve that, you know, they're not like, a lot of times you see a power reserve on like an 8-day watch or something like that, that has like a really long power reserve. And the, I don't know, Zach, what's the power reserve? What's the length on the Snowflake? It's not like absurdly long.
It's 72 hours, but you know, like right now that's not that different. You know, we have obviously 80-hour Powermatic swatch movements, but like in 2004, when this came out, there probably weren't a ton of 72-hour power reserve watches out there.
Yeah, so. That's a good point. Yeah, I just think it's, you know, like aesthetically, I think I would almost always prefer a Grand Seiko or a spring drive watch without the power reserve. But kind of like intellectually, I understand, you know, why they, you know, why they do that and why they've stuck with it. So I can defend it from that.
So yeah, it's like the date magnifier, the Cyclops on a Rolex.
Which should definitely be there, hands down.
But it's become like a visual, like some people hate it, yeah. Right? How it looks, but it's become like, whether you like it or not, like a synonymous with, like, when you see that, yeah. It kind of, you know what you're looking at.
Yeah.
Right. And it's a, yeah, kind of the same here. I think. Like those dials, you see it, like, you know, it. You yeah. associate it with, like, visually you associate it with the Grand Seikos.
Yeah. No, it's a good point. It's a very good point.
For better or worse, I guess. Yeah. One last shout out I wanted to give, and we kind of touched on this with the Nevada Grinch, and, but I feel like every time we have a new release from Fairer, there's always one of the designs that is like, has this really just oddball, odd, strange detail on it.
Yeah.
And you just kind of left scratching your head. But at the same time, like, the more I thought about it, the more that it became like, you know, I really like that Fairer always has this like really just kind of funky quirks. And that to me kind of gives the whole brand this, because they consistently do it. Where it's what is that about? Or what's going on here? Or what were they thinking there? But now it's like kind of endured me to them. Because like the date placement on that Crooms being like inside of the three. Or the word placement on that on that pilot watch. It was like halfway up.
Yeah, it was very low.
The dial, like, you know, but now like in total, I look back and I'm like, you know, these are all changes that I would make individually. But looking back as a whole, don't change anything. Like, yeah. I like that as their body of work. They've got this like signature quirks that just like make them who they are.
Yeah.
So just keep doing what you're doing.
Yeah. No one and no thing is perfect. So
yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, that's a more positive note to end on, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure.
Zach, you have anything to add?
No, I think I've aired all my grievances.
Okay.
This afternoon,
we're generally pretty agreeable.
Yeah.
Guys. Yeah. So.
And like, you know, I'll start with also like, if I couldn't change a thing on every watch, I'd be in a really, really like, I'd be frozen with choice paralysis. So, thank you for making things that I don't like 100%.
Yeah. Agreed.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Yeah. So that's our thoughts. If you have any big gripes about any weird features on watches, let us know, or let us know what we missed or what drives you up the wall. Let us know your thoughts on power reserves on Grand Seikos. And until next time, thanks for tuning in.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of the Worn & Wound podcast. If you enjoyed the show, then please leave us a review on iTunes, and also be sure to follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Looking for a new watch, a strap? Then visit windupwatchshop.com, and of course, head over to wornandwound.com daily for great watch content. Music tracks Nowhereland and Inspired are by Kevin MacLeod and are licensed under Creative Commons Attribution 3.0.